This is June Singer. Archetypes, Eternal or Evolving. Tape 3 of 3. This was recorded in 1984.
Everybody ready? Now, I want you to look at these faces of our ancestors. These are all human beings. The last one is Cro-Magnon man, who I can't tell you how many millions of years ago he emerged, but it's been quite a while. You can see a progression toward that wonderful state which we have achieved. All beauty, all intelligence. We've come a long way, haven't we? Now, I would like to ask you if you, in all due modesty, can believe that we are finally at the pinnacle, or do you think it's possible that the human body and the human intellect can go on evolving? And perhaps that one day, if we don't mess it all up, that we can be as far ahead of Cro-Magnon man as Cro-Magnon is ahead of Australopithecus. So it seems to me that if we can stand on that Archimedean point outside of our own personal history and even outside of world history, we could recognize that we're links in a very, very long chain that's continuing to evolve. And so if we did that, we would want to see, I'm sure, what our role in this evolution could be. During this century, the last in this millennium, the last in 1,000 years, we have broken through boundaries that have limited human beings for tens of thousands of years. It's as though evolution had suddenly speeded up. And our perspective has widened in ways that our grandparents couldn't even have imagined. We have, in the last 100 years, brought into daily use the telephone, radio, television, satellite, computers. I remember 1960 when Echo, the first satellite, was put up into the atmosphere. I remember it particularly because at the time I was writing stories for children about current events, and I'd written one about Echo, and I was just, again, one of those wondrous moments where something broken through consciousness, that you could put something out into space. And I thought, my God, if we could do that, what else can't we do? What else can't we put out into space? But it's these events that change our consciousness and change our view of what's possible. Now, Echo doesn't sound remarkable today. We have weather satellites all over the place. But can you imagine what our grandparents would have thought if you had told them that someday they could sit in their living room and see something that's happening in China while it was happening? The mobility that we have today is another contemporary miracle. No longer are we born and do we die within a few miles of the place where we were born, but we see more and go further. And we communicate with more people. We can have conference telephones with several people spanning great distances in all directions. And money and commerce is different from what it ever was. Business is conducted by means that would seem magical to a primitive, electronic transfers of huge sums of money. And we carry on our lives mostly even without money, mostly with plastic cards and telephones and long-distance banking. What a marvelous opportunity we have for gaining control of our world and of nature. And yet there's a shadow side to all that, because with it is the capacity to destroy all life on Earth. So finally today, like it or not, whether it's scientific or not, we have to face moral and ethical issues. And every person is responsible for the fate of the Earth, And we have to ask ourselves, I think this is the question somebody was raising, are we at the mercy of the archetype of destruction, or are we empowered by the archetype of creation? I want you to keep this question in mind as I move now to discuss the work with you of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E. Rupert Sheldrake has written what I think is a very important book. It came out in the United States in 1981, and it's called A New Science of Life. And the subtitle is The Hypothesis of Formative Causation. Some people think this book is a kind of nonsense, and some people take it very seriously. And I think there's a lot in it to be looked at, especially by people who are interested in Jung. I want to share some of this insight with you. Published by Tarcher in the United States. Now, Sheldrake, interestingly enough, is one of the new breed of New Age scientists, along with people like Fritjof Capra and David Bohm, concerned as much with the implications for humanity of the work that they're doing as with the work itself. Also, Sheldrake, like Capra and like Bohm and like Jung, particularly interested in Eastern thought. But really, this theme keeps going on and on and through and through. Rupert Sheldrake, I'll tell you how I met Rupert Sheldrake. First, I'd read his book, and I was tremendously impressed with it. And then when I was in Bombay at the International Transpersonal Conference in 1982, I heard that Rupert Sheldrake was coming. And I was looking forward to hearing him because I had read what he had written, and I thought he was very wise, and I was ready for this wise old man who was coming from Oxford, where he was a professor. And I pictured him in the typical Oxford dress and all of that. And so imagine my surprise when he finally appeared in a white yoga suit. And he's tall, dark, and handsome. And he looks like about 25, utterly charming. And he did come from the ashram of a Christian Hindu mystic, whose name is Father Bede Griffiths, whom some of you may have heard of, who's a remarkable person, a beautiful, angelic-faced, older man with snow-white hair and a long white beard and white robes. But he's British, too, both he and Sheldrake. And he has this ashram in India where people come to meditate and to study and to worship. And also there's this farm nearby the ashram, and this is where Sheldrake does his research in plant biology. And Sheldrake's fascinated with why things behave as they do and how to explore that question so that we can gain a certain kind of power, that is, so we can be empowered to act more consciously in a world that we understand a little bit better. Now, Sheldrake talks about biological morphogenesis. Morphogenesis means the beginnings of form. Morpho meaning form, and genesis meaning the beginning. So morphogenesis, biological morphogenesis, means the coming into being of characteristic and specific forms of living organisms, or why camellias grow on camellia bushes and carrots grow out of carrot seeds, and why no tomato plant has ever produced a rose. What he's trying to discover is some keys to to the cosmic ordering process. The essence of Rupert Sheldrake's hypothesis of causative formation is that there is a level of reality beyond the one we know and beyond the world of matter in which we have our finite and time-bound existence. Sound familiar? This level of reality, says Sheldrake, intangible as it is, corresponds with what Plato called the world of the ideal, what Jung called the collective unconscious, and what David Bohm calls the implicate order, what is called the superconscious in some Eastern religions and in transpersonal psychology. It's also the prima materia of the alchemist. So you see that this concept is both very old and its latest translations are very new. In this other reality, this shadow universe, if you will, from the standpoint of the ego, that is, it's a shadow universe, since we can't make out what's there, in this other reality is enfolded the potential for the reality in this world. This other world has within it the potentiality for patterning the preforms for structures of various types and species. This is what Jung called these preforms, the archetypes of the collective unconscious. I believe this is the same thing as what Sheldrake is referring to when he talks of fields in the implicate order. When we talk about archetypes in the collective unconscious, he's talking about fields in the implicate order that are morphogenetic, that is, they give rise to specific forms, species by species, with all their characteristics. And everything bears fruit according to its seed, as it says in Genesis. And there's one basic difference. Jung's archetypes give form to psychic structures. Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields, or M fields, give rise to total organisms. He doesn't differentiate between psychic and physiological structures, but looks at whole organisms. Now, I want to interrupt here to say that some people have asked, what is there about transpersonal psychology that's different from Jungian psychology? Jung's psychology deals with psyche, primarily. The body is kind of recognized as a sort of a vehicle in which the psyche functions, but Jung doesn't pay a lot of attention to the body. But transpersonal psychology looks at the total organism, which includes body. And that means then that if we're transpersonal psychologists, we don't only sit around and analyze ourselves and each other in our dreams, but we're really concerned about our bodies. We're concerned about what we put into our bodies, because what we think sometimes has to do with the nutrition in the brain and how strong we are, what kind of energy we have has to do with exercise and physical strength and mobility and all of these things, so that we're really concerned with body. We're also concerned that the psyche, when it has different kinds of experiences, that those experiences don't get lodged in the body, that we don't somatize. So we're very concerned with that flow. And it's not a flow between psyche and body. I want to make that clear. We're not talking about two entities. We're talking about flow, which is psychic and physical, both, all in one. This is one experience. And you can look at it as a psychologist and see only psyche. You can look at it as a physiologist and see only what's going on in the body. Or I would hope that we would be able to look at it as a total, from a total organismic perspective and see the whole thing. So now, these M fields, these morphogenetic fields that Sheldrake is talking about, are responsible for the organization of not only the archetypal developments, but the instinctual developments. Jung and Freud, Jung made a distinction between the archetypal and the instinctual, and he said that the archetypal had to do with our psychic patterning, and the instinctual had to do with our bodily impulses of sex and hunger and such. And Sheldrake doesn't make that differentiation. He is talking about one kind of patterning of the whole organism. I want to hold for questions for a moment and get through this idea. So morphogenesis postulates another level of consciousness that's preformed and that precedes creation, which is a model for creation, a superior entelechy, if you will. This approach is not new. It's only new to Western science since Descartes and Newton. In alchemy, we have the idea as above, so below, which is not a sense of two different things really, but recognizing that the world in which we live is a microcosm of the totality, just as a drop of water is a microcosm of the ocean. And we have it also in other philosophical approaches, particularly Taoism, where there is great knowledge preceding small knowledge. Now, most molecular biologists, as a rule, don't go along with Sheldrake's theory, or perhaps they haven't considered it. It's really quite new to scientific exploration. Most molecular biologists, as far as I know, favor a more mechanistic theory of biological morphogenesis. That is, they understand that DNA is responsible for the particular patterns of growth in living organisms, that there's a protein synthesis, a chemical pattern which accounts for the genetic material in all organisms. They believe that adaptation, that is the way that organisms change over time, is explained by mutation, this rare, freaky type of form appearing suddenly for reasons that aren't fully clear, and that these new forms are subject to natural selection. We touched on that previously. Those adaptations which are most successful and which are most fit to survive and to reproduce themselves are the ones that survive. So molecular biologists combine the work that's been done with DNA in the field of genetics with Darwin's work on the survival of the fittest, which of course means those fittest to reproduce, not necessarily the most ideal creature in terms of human values, but those who can make it and produce offspring. So the idea is, then, that those organisms which are fittest to reproduce survive, and the mutations that are harmful, that don't reproduce well, disappear. So this is a kind of neo-Darwinian theory, and many molecular biologists believe that it can account for a kind of apparent purposiveness. They don't need to presume any mysterious factor, any vital factor, life principle or divine principle. They believe, or say they believe, that it just somehow happens that way. The protein synthesis happens to create complex living organisms species by species, and that mutations just occur by chance and are perpetuated by good luck. Some of us think that's harder to believe than Sheldrake's theory. But there are some problems here. New structures appear from time to time. They can't be explained in terms of what is in the egg at the beginning. Now, if I have the next slide. Here's an example of a new structure appearing. Developing systems can be said to self-regulate. So what happens here is that here we have a normal embryo of a dragonfly. Now the experiment is that uh, the normal embryo was tied off before the dragonfly started to develop. And you see it's tied off there. There's a part above and a part below that girdle. Now, it's very interesting that what you get here is not half a dragonfly, but you get the whole dragonfly, which that embryo has been able to create itself out of only one half of its genetic stuff. That's really quite remarkable when you think about it, that it has been able to self-regulate its development. This suggests that the entire potentiality for the development of the dragonfly existed in whatever part of it was below that ligature. We also know, of course, that there would be nothing in Darwin's theory to explain this, and nothing in DNA to explain it. The DNA theory suggests that development goes on according to a chemically pre-programmed plan. But when the plan is interfered with, as here, the organism seems to have the ability to correct the error. Now the next slide. Here's another piece, another example of experimentation that Sheldrake cites. He says that organisms are able to repair damaged structures without any previous experience of how to do it. They've not learned how to do it. Now this experiment shows that something inherent in the organism is operating. See, what's happened here in the first picture is that the lens of the eye of the newt has been removed surgically. See, that's been cut out in the first picture. I'm talking about some of the problems of morphogenesis. Now, no newt in the history of newt kind has ever had an eye removed surgically, as far as we know. So there's no way that one newt could teach another how to reproduce the lens of an eye. So what the scientists did in this experiment was to excise the lens of the newt's eye, cut into the iris, remove the lens. Now over time, 30 days altogether, the iris, which is supposedly of a different kind of tissue from the lens, begins to grow and develop a kind of structure on the end of it, which then enlarges and grows, and finally is formed and comes into being as a new lens. Now, there's no way the newt could have learned how to do this. There's no way that natural selection could explain it. It doesn't come from a history of lens-renewing newts. The DNA theory suggests that the same DNA pattern is in every similar structure. But suddenly this formal pattern has shifted from what it was programmed to be. It's really very mysterious. The explanation that Sheldrake comes to is that what happened in the M field, that is the morphogenetic field governing the form of species newt, that there is a pattern for a lens in the eye, and that the newt tunes into it somehow and is able to perceive how to develop it that way. Sheldrake uses the term morphic resonance to describe what happens when one tunes into unconscious patterns, or as we would say, when one tunes into an archetypal pattern. Sounds a little bit far out. But when you consider that we talk about our archetype, we're talking about a pattern that we tune into. We talk about being under the influence of an archetype. We talk about being ruled by an archetype. We talk about patterns evolving in human behavior, even when they're not taught, or in animal behavior as well. It's a very old question, and it even goes back to sometimes poets describe it better than scientists. Whenever I want to get ahead of the scientists, I read poetry. But let me read you a little section from my friend William Blake again, who raised this very question a century before Jung. And he's asking about where these species patterns come from? Blake, with what sense is it that the chicken shuns the ravenous hawk? With what sense does the tame pigeon measure out the expanse? With what sense does the bee form cells? Have not the mouse and frogs eyes and ears and sense of touch? Yet are their habitations and their pursuits as different as their forms and as their joys? Ask the wild ass why he refuses burdens, and the meek camel why he loves man. Is it because of eye, ear, mouth, or skin, or breathing nostrils? No, for these the wolf and tiger have. Ask the blind worm the secrets of the grave, and why her spires love to curl round the bones of death. And ask the ravenous snake where she gets the poison, and the winged eagle why he loves the sun. And then tell me the thoughts of man that have been hid of old. So let's have the next slide, please. So this particular behavior, species by species, is always in harmony with its a priori patterns. When a bird of a particular species, when its egg is placed in the nest of another species, you may have read about this in the studies of Nobel Prize winner Konrad Lorenz. When that bird hatches and goes off to migrate, it doesn't follow the foster mother in her migration, but it knows where its species goes, and that's where it goes, without having been taught and with no example to follow. And the little baby turtles, the turtle eggs are buried in the sand, and when they hatch out, these little baby turtles know in which direction they must run to get to the sea, and they have to run very quickly without even stopping to look around before the hungry seagulls pick them off. They know how to behave. They are tuned in, according to Sheldrake, into some kind of pattern that was present in their cellular structure, the same way that this flower knows how to bloom and open. And I'd like to have the next slide, please. And the next one. And the next, and finally the next. So these patterns are preordained, and they have a capacity for going forward step by step, each according to its own species. Another aspect of this is behavioral regulation. Sheldrake refers to this as the capacity to tune in to the M field to find out how to function. And he gives an interesting example of a dog, after having one leg amputated, learns how to regulate its motor activities so that it can move along on three legs without ever having been taught or without an example. Now, another dog with a part of a cerebral hemisphere removed is also able to regulate its nervous activity, its central nervous system. And a dog who is faced with obstacles in its path knows how to get around them. All three dogs can get from place to place despite disturbances in motor organs, in the central nervous system, and in the environment. So there are factors of learning and intelligent behavior, but there's also non-learned behavior. Just why does this species do this and that species do that, and how do they know? How do we know what we have not learned in this lifetime? Of course, we can go back to Jung and his idea of a common substrata, the collective unconscious containing archetypal forms that could be interpreted as collective memories. We see that they extend beyond our personal experience, and that these ways of functioning somehow are transmitted. We don't know exactly how, and Jung doesn't try to say how, but it does appear that we somehow tune in to the collective memory of the species. It makes good sense from the interactive view taken by Jung, that is the view of mind-body integration, that the mind can somehow tune into the body's patterns. And yet, the body's patterns are simply a manifesting of latent or implicate order patterns. And of course, this whole idea of tuning into a kind of general patterning field, a morphogenetic field, could help to account for some of the phenomena that we can't really account for in the field, for example, of parapsychology. It would account for some of the phenomena that Jung called synchronicity. Do you ever have an experience of somehow being tuned into an idea or an image, and when you're tuned in, you see it everywhere? I remember when I was writing my book, Androgyny. Before I started it, you know, I never thought much about androgynes. When I got into it, really into it, every place I looked, everything I'd pick up would be images of androgynes everywhere. And it seemed that when I got into consideration of this archetype, it seemed that every place I looked, I began to see it. It's very interesting, this business of tuning in. It can all be explained away by coincidence. But there seems to be a lot more meaning beyond just happenstance. Extrasensory perception, clairvoyance, even tuning into what appears as a past life. Have any of you had that kind of experience? Okay. Seems clear that when people are enabled to enter into an altered state of consciousness, they're able to re-experience or experience something that they haven't experienced or don't remember experiencing in this life. And it's so vivid and so detailed that it's hard to believe it's made up. Interestingly enough, not too many people recognize this. Now, Jung's doctoral dissertation was about a young woman who had experienced other lives than her present one. She even spoke a dialect of old High German that she'd never heard in the town where she was born and reared. You might be interested in reading that study sometime. It's in volume one of the collected works. Sheldrake quotes Jung on archetypes, saying, now this is Jung as Sheldrake, who knew Jung's work quite well, quoted him. Sheldrake says, in addition to our immediate consciousness, which is of a thoroughly personal nature and which we believe to be the only empirical psyche, even if we tack on the personal unconscious as an appendix, in addition, there is a second psychic system of a collective, universal, impersonal nature which is identical in almost all individuals. This collective unconscious does not develop individually but is inherited. It consists of pre-existent forms, the archetypes, which can only become conscious secondarily and which give definite form to psychic content. Jung suggested that these archetypal forms could be found in germ plasma. Sheldrake expands upon this, saying, mental phenomena don't need to depend on physical laws, but may follow laws of their own. Now, Jung was never a mechanist. He never took a purely physical view, but in his early days, you might say he was an interactionist. That is, he was interested in the interaction of psyche and soma, mind and body. Physical structures of organisms are endowed with something that has been called an entelechy, a sort of archetypal structure. That is, the material form carries the potential for psychological patterns of behavior. The characteristic pattern imposed on a physical and chemical system by the archetype would depend on the kind of setting of the archetype itself, the spatial and temporal setting. So a sea urchin would develop the way it does because of its archetypal patterning, containing the, in quotes, memory of all previous sea urchins. Larval and adult sea urchins would be able By tuning into this archetypal patterning to direct normal development, even if the physical structure of the embryo were damaged, as we saw with the embryo of the dragonfly. So this suggests, and I believe that Jung would have agreed, that even if the psyche suffers trauma, it can regenerate the damaged aspect, and that the archetypal background of the psyche provides the necessary information to restore psychic health or wholeness. This is a very exciting idea, because we think we've been taught when the psyche is damaged, that really the best you can do is a patch-up job and a repair job. But to think that the image of wholeness and health is present, if we can just learn how to tune into it, represents a whole new potential for working with human beings. Let's talk a minute about how worldviews or how paradigms change. There's a very important book that was written quite a long time ago. It's just one of those books that, for me, just opened up a whole new way of thinking, and that's Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution. That's K-U-H-N, in case you want to get hold of it. He talks about how perception changes and how new paradigms or worldviews come into being. He says that ordinarily, there's a certain kind of consensus, the general consensus knowledge that the scientific world holds and that people believe in it and they hold fast to it. Now, the Newtonian paradigm in physics would be an example of this. And then people begin discovering things that don't fit into that picture. And there's no explanation for the things that they discover. And either they get discouraged and stop their research, or they stay with it and people think they're a little crazy or far out, as some people do with people like Sheldrake. And after a while, these new ideas become a little more persistent and more people start taking them up. And the scientists then get more disturbed and they feel more uncomfortable and they can't explain what people are thinking about and the questions that they're asking in terms of their science. And they can say for a certain amount of time, well, that's just not my field of inquiry, but sooner or later they have to face it. So finally there comes a breakthrough where there's a larger view side by side with the old one, the larger view incorporating the new findings. And then the larger view is finally taken up. And it's not necessarily that the larger view is taken up by the old scientists who see the error of their ways and decide to become much more open-minded. What generally happens is that the older scientists get old and tired of arguing, and the younger, more energetic scientists finally graduate with their PhDs and get big jobs in the graduate schools, and then their ideas come into prominence. So, how many of you know about the 100th monkey? Okay, well, that's a kind of interesting story, and I'll just briefly recount it. For those of you who haven't heard about it, Lyle Watson has related this in his book, I believe, Lifetide. He talked about some monkeys who lived on an island off the coast of Japan, and they were in the habit of eating sweet potatoes with lots of dirt on them. So one day, apparently, and this may be a parable. One day, one monkey suddenly conceived the idea of going down to the seashore and washing a sweet potato. And it was a young monkey, because older monkeys knew better than to do anything like that. So this young monkey washed the sweet potato and ate it, and his parents noticed it, and they also tried to wash their sweet potatoes, and They did, and they seemed to like the sweet potatoes that weren't full of sand. And pretty soon other monkeys started washing their sweet potatoes. And then there came to be a point where, symbolically speaking, the 100th monkey was washing sweet potatoes. And then on another island, at some distance, suddenly all the monkeys started washing sweet potatoes. Well, this is supposed to happen, and it's kind of strange, and it brings me to another aspect of Sheldrake's theory, and that's what Sheldrake calls the hypothesis of morphic resonance, which is to say that there's a tuning in that happens at a certain point when the signals get loud enough that it's possible to tune into a patterning process and to go with it. And I think I can give you an illustration of that if we can have the next slide. Now, this is a representation of a creode, which is actually a groove or channel. Now, what happened when the first monkey started washing sweet potatoes is he began washing a little channel, symbolically speaking, in the collective unconscious, the sweet potato washing channel, so to speak. So the pattern of behavior began to be slightly modified. And when that happened over and over again, that pattern became more deeply channelized. And the more that it happened, the more that it was likely to happen. So that as that groove deepened, as that particular behavior became established more and more in the species, it was more and more likely to occur. As you've often seen with behavior in a group, the more that something happens, the more it's likely to happen. Well, the idea is that when something happens, it gets incorporated into our way of functioning, not only consciously, but also in our unconscious patterns. Like when you learn to drive a car, after a while, you're not thinking about how to do everything. It's in your unconscious. And when patterns become incorporated in the unconscious of sufficient numbers of people or animals or plant life or whatever it is, the pattern itself is affected, and that's the amazing thing. Let's have the next slide, please. Now, this is a diagram that talks about the effect, the influence of the past on subsequent similar systems. This is about morphic resonance. Now, morphic resonance is that process of tuning in. Now, here's the first time something happens. Okay? Now, the next time it happens, you're getting input from the original response and from the second response. Now, the next time it happens, you're getting input from the third response, from the second response, and from the first response. And finally, you see, the possibility of that happening increases by the cumulative effect of that behavior having taken place. The second monkey, and the third monkey is affected by the first and second, and so on. The patterning gets stronger and stronger the more that happens. Well, what happens then, according to Sheldrake, is that the field, the morphogenetic field, the area, I say area symbolically because I don't think you could locate it up there in the stratosphere, but the tendency to reproduce human behavior becomes strengthened the more that people do it. Next slide, please. Okay, now, this is not only a scientific idea, but you'll, if you listen carefully, you'll notice it's an ethical idea, too. And this slide here, not about ethics, it's about fish, but it shows you how very subtly an organism changes. And there's the initial field, the morphic field, which dictates the process, But the magnetic field changes, and then the manifestation in the outer world begins to change too. Perhaps you are getting a sense of what we're coming to. But I wanted to say something about the ethics, because I think it's real important not to do our psychic or our scientific exploration in a vacuum, but to understand that whatever we're doing has far wider implications, and that becomes then the province of ethics. What good is it? The recognition that since the more things happen, the more they're going to happen. And the more we behave in a certain way, the more that's going to become, or more likely to become, a pattern. But the more people behave destructively, and the more that destructive element affects the collective unconscious, and the more people behave with love and caring and with an awareness of the unity of all things, the stronger that kind of behavior gets to be. These forces can be weakened, too, because there are also opposite influences going on. Whatever we do, wherever it's happening with us, on the conscious level, there's also a repression of the opposite. There are always counter forces and tendencies to move forward as well as backward. So it's really important to recognize that we are in a process of evolution, and the more conscious we are about it, the better. Now, this whole business of the morphogenetic field may be a little difficult to understand. So Sheldrake has put it into terms that I think really give a beautiful picture, a very clear picture, and I want to just give you the analogy that he presented. He said these ideas, the ideas about morphogenetic fields and inheritability of acquired characteristics, all of that stuff, these ideas are extremely unfamiliar and would perhaps be easier to grasp with the help of an analogy. Imagine an intelligent and curious person who knows nothing about electricity or electromagnetic radiation. He's shown a television set for the first time. He might at first suppose that the set actually contained little people whose images he saw on the screen. But when he looked inside and found only wires, condensers, transistors, and so forth, he might adopt the more sophisticated hypothesis that the images somehow arose from the complicated interactions among the components of the set. This hypothesis would seem particularly plausible when he found that the images become distorted or disappeared when some of the components were removed. If the suggestion were put to him that the images, in fact, depended upon invisible influences entering the set from far away, he might reject it on the grounds that it was unnecessarily obscurantist. His opinion that nothing came into the set from the outside world would be reinforced by the discovery that the set weighed as much switched on as switched off. This point of view may resemble the conventional approach to biology. By contrast, in terms of this analogy, the hypothesis of formative causation does not involve a denial of the importance of wires and transistors and so forth corresponding to DNA or protein molecules, but it recognizes, in addition, the role of influences transmitted from outside the system, the transmitters being past organisms of the same species. Genetic changes can infect the inheritance of former instincts by altering the tuning or by introducing distortions into the reception. But genetic factors cannot by themselves fully account for the inheritance of form and instinct any more than the particular pictures on the screen of the TV set can be explained in terms of its wiring diagram alone. I think that helps. It also helps me when I think that the question that was raised, how well do we know that we can't have a mechanistic explanation for it, that our current explanations just don't give us enough to go on, and that we just really have to find something further. It seems to me that we recognize that as we evolve our consciousness, we begin to perceive things that we couldn't perceive before. So it is that an idea will pop up in different parts of the world, and people will invent the same thing very close in time. And it's possibly because of this process of each generation reinforcing the next that the archetypal world is somehow enlarged or enriched or changed by experience. Maybe that's also why, or what will account for the emergence of scientific discoveries in different places at different times. Remember when Darwin came to his theory of evolution, there was someone else who had worked out almost the same precise theory in another part of the world. Now, there's an interesting behavior done to check out this instinctive behavior, an interesting experiment done to check out this instinctive behavior and the effects of this morphogenetic resonance. It was started, the experiments themselves were started long before Sheldrake came on the scene, but they were experiments in genetics, and they were really done to test out something quite different. But as so many experiments do, they came out with findings that were never anticipated by the people who designed the experiments. Over a period of about 15 years, it was in the 1930s, I believe, a psychologist by the name of McDougall was testing rats. And of course, we're not much interested in rat psychology, but when rats appear to have archetypes, maybe we'll pay more attention. At any rate, these rats were trained to run a maze filled with water and to get out of it by taking one of two paths. One was along a dark passage and one was along a light passage. And at the beginning of this experiment, now remember this was done over 15 years, with 32 generations of rats, some people are very patient. Now when they started, it took a couple of hundred tries on an average for a rat to find its way through the maze. And according to the conventional theory, there should be no increase in the rate of learning speed of rats going through the maze in the next generation. It shouldn't matter whether they were the descendants of rats who had been trained to go through the maze or rats who are not trained. Rats who had not been exposed to mass training, to mazes, rats who had not been exposed to training, should all start from point zero. Now, about the time this was going on, a scientist by the name of Lamarck had an idea that the descendants of trained rats should learn more quickly than the descendants of untrained rats. He had a theory that learned behavior could be inherited. And, of course, this was not very respectable scientifically. So what McDougall was doing was trying to test out Lamarck's theory and, obviously, to prove him wrong. So he went through this process of breeding rats from parents that were trained and untrained. With the offspring of the trained rats, he found that, interestingly enough, generation after generation, they did improve. These young rats had never been exposed to learning before the experiment. Well, this was kind of remarkable because scientists were saying this just didn't happen. So they started just, you know, to really check out their experience. They thought they'd check on the generations of the untrained rats. And by God, and their maze learning rate didn't improve too, generation after generation. This is really amazing. So what was that all about? There must be some explanation. What's very interesting was that they started experimenting with the offspring of the trained rats. And they decided the trained rats, well, they must somehow be passing this on. The smart rats were passing this on. So they separated the ones who learned quickly from the slower learners. And then they took from the untrained rats the offspring of those who learned the most slowly. So they started breeding them. And then they tested the smart rats from the trained rat families and the slow rats from the untrained rat families. And by God, they didn't both learn faster than the previous generation of trained rats. The smart descendants of the trained rats learned a little faster, but the stupid descendants of the untrained rats learned almost as fast. Well, now this experiment was quite mystifying. Since there wasn't a very good explanation, it was kind of put aside, and nobody knew just what to do with this. This is what usually happens with scientific research that doesn't prove what you set out to prove. But quite a bit later, you know, eventually some graduate student is going to pick it up. And quite a bit later, a graduate student, I believe, by the name of Crewe, decided to replicate McDougall's experiment. So he was going to start at the very beginning with untrained rats. And he really didn't have to replicate the experiment. Because when he started, these untrained rats, and it's a whole new fresh batch, same species, these rats learned to run the maze as fast as the rats who had been trained by McDougall at the end of his experiment. These were the same breed as McDougall's rats, but they were never exposed to the maze, and they were not related to McDougall's trained rats. Well, Sheldrake says that this is suggestive of the influence of the past generations influencing an entire species, and this accounts for that there is a morphogenetic field which affects the subsequent generation. Well, I think that I've said enough now to give you a sense of the way in which archetypes and other more current, more scientifically respectable or acceptable explanations of these processes, the way that they grow and evolve. On a certain level, they are eternal. They have a way of leading to behavior of the species. But on another level, it seems to me they're evolving. And it seems to me that this is the important point, that we don't have, like, Crewe's rats to go back to the beginning in our human consciousness, but that we have the ability to raise the human race to higher levels of consciousness and for us to begin where our parents or grandparents left off and to move onwards from there. And I think, too, in our study of Jungian psychology, that to go with Jung and to understand what he's talking about provides us with a marvelous background and a great springboard. But I think Jung would have been the first to have said, don't stop there, but move on and see where these ideas take you and add them to what you are learning and increase your knowledge and your capacity to deal with the world in a more conscious way. Essentially, that's what I have to say. And we have maybe 10 minutes if you would like to make some comments or ask some questions before we close. Yes. I don't know where it was done. It was a man by the name of McDougall who was the primary researcher. Okay. Elliot Pergesine is one of them. Who are working in this field, and it's very much in the air today. You'll find it popping up all over. It's, I'm sure, the science of the next few years. It's, there are many names that could be mentioned that are working in this area. Anybody else? Yes. Yes, I think that's a very important question. And there's a tremendous amount of energy being put forth by our government and other governments to prepare for war, for nuclear war. I don't think the people are behind it. I don't think the American people, and I don't think the Russian people, and I certainly don't think the people of Western Europe are eager to see more armaments built and a movement toward war. And I think we have to keep talking about it, and we have to keep meeting about it, and we have to keep expressing our voice. How many of you saw the on television the symposium with the Democratic candidate, hopeful? How many of them expressed the feeling that they really wanted to outlaw nuclear armaments? They really wanted to freeze as soon as possible. This would not have happened 2 years ago. There's a tremendous change coming up from the bottom. Sooner or later, the political leaders have got to hear. We have got to talk. We have got to spread the word. We have got to put our vote out there, support the candidates. The candidates are our representatives, and we have the power to make them vote for what we believe in if we put our energy behind it, if we have enough hope and enough courage to not feel impotent, but to feel that we have the power. I just make it my small contribution that wherever I go to speak, I mention this issue just to bring it to consciousness. And as often as I have occasion to, whether I'm teaching, whether I'm talking to a friend, whatever, to keep impressing my sense that I, as one individual, have power, just as every one of you have.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.